This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
You may have the day off today, but the news, it just keeps on coming. From North Korea to DACA to Harvey, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdal. Thanks so much for joining us this Labor Day, September 4th. North Korea detonated what it's IDing as a hydrogen bomb on Sunday, upping tensions again. Over on Fox News Sunday, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said he was working on plans to do more to cut off North Korea's economy.
We've already started with sanctions against North Korea, but I am going to draft a sanctions package to send to the president for his strong consideration that anybody that wants to do trade or business with them would be prevented from doing trade or business with us.
When you look at the list of who does trade or business with North Korea, there's a biggie on there. China. For more, we've got Joda Thomas. He's a former U.S. ambassador and now at Penn State School of International Affairs. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
How do you think China's sort of thinking about this right now? They're in a little bind here.
They have been trying to make this issue go away for a long time, and it won't go away. So they're, I'm sure, deeply unhappy right now.
What are the choices they face realistically?
From their point of view, having a nuclear weapons-possessing North Korea is a bad outcome. It's just only the third worst outcome.
What are the two worst?
The two worst are the collapse of an Asian communist regime on their border, and the second one would be a second Korean War on their border. So they're looking at this and trying to figure out how they don't get the third without having one of the other two hit them.
Why hasn't China been more willing to cut economic ties with North Korea? You mentioned this idea of regional stability. Can you talk me through that?
Yes. From China's perspective, especially now, I mean, in terms of foreign trade, North Korea is totally dependent on China. And that includes some things that are key, like oil. So China knows if it really puts the pressure on, three bad things could happen. The first one is that the North Koreans might do something truly nuts, either to them or to the South Koreans or who knows whom. The second concern they have is that the regime could collapse and with it the entire state in North Korea. And then China is left with a mess on its border. You know, hundreds of thousands of refugees, a collapsed communist state, all kinds of scrambling between the Americans, the South Koreans, and the Chinese over the remains. That doesn't sound very appealing to them.
Then now we have on the flip side President Trump and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin threatening to sanction China or stop trade with China if it doesn't do more to help with North Korea. Also not a good outcome.
Agreed. and for us as well. Sanctioning China, I mean, if you're saying sanctioning some Chinese entity that's doing something with North Korea that it shouldn't, now we've done that already and we'll continue to do it. And I hope the Trump administration does sanction people who are giving aid and comfort to the North Korean nuclear program. But if you are talking about a point blank, if if your country trades with North Korea, we will not trade with you. That is about as close to holding a gun to your own head and saying, one more step and I'll shoot.
Why?
Well, you know, we have over $600 billion of trade with China. Many of our companies are dependent on Chinese manufacturers as sources of parts for their own goods. Our premier companies are dependent on the Chinese market. So if you're saying China trade with North Korea or trade with us, it is possible the Chinese will blink. Hmm. And that means, you know, you're saying, well, let's substitute our concern about nuclear war in Asia with a major global economic crisis. There's got to be a better approach than saying we will set off a major economic crisis in the world if everybody doesn't do what we tell them to do.
Joe DeThomas is former U.S. ambassador and now at Penn State School of International Affairs. Thanks so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
U.S. markets were closed today for the holidays. International markets, they were jittery. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are reports that President Trump might announce plans tomorrow to roll back the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also called DACA. DACA protects undocumented immigrants brought into the country as children. Now, the president could change his mind on this one, but news outlets are reporting the plan would give Congress 6 months to come up with an alternative. Corporate leaders have come to the defense of DACA. Hundreds of CEOs, from Apple's Tim Cook to Amazon's Jeff Bezos, signed on to a letter urging Trump and Congress to preserve the program. But that didn't work for, you know, the Paris Climate Agreement. So why do it? Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
Longtime DACA proponents are glad to see companies weigh in. Jorge Mario Cabrera is with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles. It's processed more than 10,000 DACA applications over the past 5 years. He would hope that to a businessman like President Trump, a pro-DACA message from CEOs would mean something.
And that he will heed their warning that ending DACA would be disastrous, not only for specific businesses, but for the economy in general.
More than 700,000 DACA recipients are believed to hold jobs in the U.S. 72% of the top 25 Fortune 500 companies have DACA employees on the payroll. But marketing professor Daniel Korshan at Drexel University says that's not the only way the debate touches companies' bottom lines.
They're also concerned with the behaviors and the reactions of consumers and their own employee base. Are they going to face a boycott if they don't say something about this?
The DACA letter is part of a flurry of political activity by companies since the inauguration, whether pushing to keep the U.S. on track with climate change or condemning Trump's statements after Charlottesville. Americus Reed is a marketing professor at the Wharton School. He says past pressure from business leaders hasn't changed Trump's mind.
But I think it's important for them to feel like when history is written, we're on the record being on the right side of that history.
Even if Trump decides to repeal DACA, business advocacy could mean something to Congress and how strongly it acts to save the program. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Hurricane Harvey knocked out almost a quarter of the U.S. refining capacity. The average gas price in the U.S. is now about $2.64 for a gallon of regular, according to AAA. That's up about a quarter from last week. ExxonMobil says it's working on restarting its Baytown refinery, which is the second largest refinery in the country. Marketplace's Andy Euler looks at how the industry is coming back online.
Restarting an oil refinery isn't like starting up a lawnmower. Inspectors must make sure every pipe, joint, valve, control box, and circuit is in working order. It's almost like starting from scratch.
This is as strenuous and important activity as and when you start a new plant up.
That's Sam Manan. He teaches chemical engineering at Texas A&M University.
And once each piece of equipment are certified to be fit for service, that's when you then start your regular startup operations.
Workers need to be there to do the inspections and run the machines. For those whose houses and vehicles were flooded during the storm, that means temporary housing and transportation to and from the plant. And that's just to get the refinery running. Then you have to get the refined goods where they need to go. Danny Perez is with the Texas Department of Transportation Houston District.
For the most part, the roads are clear in our area. We are seeing some further east when you get into Beaumont. So that may have some impacts for transport of materials and items trying to leave the Houston area.
A major pipeline to move the refinery's product is expected to start up again this week, too. Daniel Cohan is an air quality expert at Rice University in Houston. He says restarting the oil industry brings health trade-offs. Keeping things safe often means more pollution.
They need to make sure their workers are safe. They need to be sure there's not an explosion. And so they're allowed to flare products. They're allowed to vent some products so that you have air pollution, but you don't have a more catastrophic problem.
Cohan says there's an orange haze all around Houston. Restarting refineries will add to an already bad atmosphere. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Oregon recently passed a law that will require some large employers to give their employees their schedule at least a week ahead of time. It's the first state in the country with a law in the books that's a pushback against on-call scheduling, especially common in low-income jobs. Other cities around the country are also taking up schedule predictability laws, so workers can plan around work and have some sense of how many hours they're going to get paid for in a week. From Los Angeles, Larry Buell reports.
Nadine Vassallo manages the independent bookseller Book Soup in West Hollywood.
This is a very low-tech scheduling system using a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet.
She has 20 full and part-time employees.
We try to be really sensitive to make sure that we're not forcing anyone to come in if they're not available.
But larger companies are more likely to use scheduling software to plug workers into shifts, sometimes without taking employee needs into account. Natasha Castro says that when she was studying at UCLA and working in retail and food service, she felt like she had to jump when she was called into work.
Managers, like if you will talk to them about the schedule, they'll blame it on the software and say, oh, we didn't have any input in it, it's just made the schedule.
Employee advocates say shift workers need more regularity and flexibility in their schedules, and lawmakers are starting to agree. Laws passed recently in Oregon, New York City, Seattle, and San Francisco attempt to cut down scheduling practices that drive shift workers crazy, like last-minute schedule changes and penalties for turning down shifts, and clopenings.
Closing a shift late at night and then coming back early in the morning.
Rachel Deutsch is an attorney at the Center for Popular Democracy. She says those back-to-back shifts can make for sleepy workers.
Which can be particularly a problem when folks have long commutes.
Employees in retail, food service, and hospitality tend to have very erratic schedules. How erratic? A 2016 study from the UCLA Center for Labor Research and Education asked about 560 workers under 30 years old in L.A. County about their schedules. Yana Shadik Hernandez is a professor of labor studies at UCLA. She oversaw that study, which found most of those surveyed
had experienced at least one challenging work practice in that week, whether it was, you know, being asked to be on call or not getting advance notice, or that their schedules fluctuated so they had no predictability, whether they're going to work this week 20 hours or in the following week 40 hours.
And when you don't know your schedule, you don't know how much money you'll make. Taking a second job is tough if both companies expect you to be on call. Worker advocates put a lot of blame on just-in-time workforce scheduling technology. Using algorithms, those programs estimate fluctuations in customer traffic, right down to the hour, so employers always have exactly the right number of workers. Again, Rachel Deutsch.
Technology is really responsible for a lot of the unpredictability because it allowed companies to really squeeze their labor budgets.
But software makers say technology doesn't have to treat employees like inventory. Eric Hawthorne is vice president of products at Snap Schedule. He puts the onus back on managers.
Because if they attempt, you know, too many times to schedule across when the employee isn't available or doesn't want to be available, then the employee isn't going to stick around, especially in this market.
And worker advocates say that if managers considered employee needs more often, some lawmakers might not feel the need to do it for them. In Los Angeles, I'm Larry Buell for Marketplace.
Coming up?
We saw a beautiful farm. I said to my wife, man, if only we could go camping there.
Camping in the sharing economy. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed today for the holiday. This is the 123rd Labor Day. President Grover Cleveland declared it back in 1894. America adopted its first mandatory minimum wage in 1938. It was 25 cents an hour. Today, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. Foreign stocks fell amid North Korea tensions. South Korea's market fell 1.1%. Japan's Nikkei dipped 0.9%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. If you stayed out of the movie theaters this long weekend, you weren't alone. There just wasn't that much new out there to see. No big releases, at least. The studios seem to just abandon the holiday. The box office take for the four-day weekend is expected to be in the mid-$90 million range. And according to The Hollywood Reporter, it'll be the worst Labor Day weekend for Hollywood in 2 decades. The long weekend wraps up an all-in-all disappointing summer box office. For more, we've got The Hollywood Reporter's Pamela McClintock with us now. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So why isn't there some big blockbuster movie in the theaters this weekend?
It is truly an unfortunate series of events. You know, Labor Day is never a big weekend for big studio releases, but there's usually a number of smaller genre films. And this year, people just either moved movies off or didn't put movies here. So it's the first time in 25 years that there wasn't a new major nationwide release over Labor Day.
Why? What happened?
I'd call it a case of maybe poor scheduling, where just nobody put their movies on Labor Day this year. So while it's never a huge weekend, you know, you can certainly do some business.
As a whole, how would you judge the summer?
It's going to be down nearly 16%, which is the biggest year-over-year decline that anybody can remember.
Huh.
And I think revenue may eke out at $3.8 billion, and that's the first time in more than a decade that summer revenue hasn't hit $4 billion.
So what happened?
You know, I think there was a lot. One thing that happened was Rotten Tomatoes really came into its own now that it's owned by Fandango, and movies like Transformers or Baywatch just got crucified by poor reviews.
And the idea here, as I understand it, is that now that when I go to Fandango, I see these Rotten Tomato scores before I buy my tickets, I'm much more aware of a bomb.
Exactly. I did a piece about this very aspect. It would sort of be like Volkswagen or another car company putting stories like Consumer Reports right there.
Right. Don't click the review.
You know, it's sort of an odd placement because there's really not a lot of incentive if a movie has a 15% rotten rating to go.
So that's one piece of it. Other things that you'd attribute the bad summer to, where they're just not the movies there?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, I do think we're seeing the effect of, you know, everyone says this, so I sound like a broken record, but of Netflix and Amazon, there's just so much good television and, you know, wherever you're getting it on TV.
Is this summer going to be the summer that causes a change in business strategy, do you think, from either the theater perspective or the studio perspective?
I'm not sure. I think the wheel turns so much more slowly. I mean, the studios already have their, you know, next summer's set, and it's just as chock full of sequels and reboots. And on paper, it looks a lot stronger. But, you know, I think there is a nervousness about when you're seeing, you know, numerous sequels and numerous reboots, can they really hold their own?
So maybe a couple summers from now, we'll see some new stuff, huh?
Here's hoping. I mean, I've been asking everybody in town, you know, how are the conversations changing in the production meetings? And so far, I haven't found a very good mole, but, you know, I think there's got to be true alarm going on.
Pamela McClintock is senior film writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Labor Day marks the end of summer and one of the busiest camping weekends of the year. Popular campsites often fill up months and months in advance, which got some entrepreneurs thinking, why not come up with a way to let folks camp on private land? Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker reports.
Michael D'Agostino just wanted to get away for a relaxing weekend. A couple years ago, he was working in finance in New York City. He and his wife drove to New Jersey and got the last campsite at a state campground.
And we were across the car track from 40 or more people who were having a Wiccan party on the night of the full moon.
He remembers people dressed in robes drinking mead under a disco ball.
It was like camping in Times Square.
The next morning, exhausted, they headed back to New York.
But on the way there, we saw a beautiful farm. And I said to my wife, man, if only we could go camping there. And then it sort of hit me like a lightning bolt. What if we could go camping there?
From that aha moment came his company, Tenter. It allows people to book fully equipped campsites on private farms and rural homesteads from southern Maine to eastern Pennsylvania. On the other side of the country, Alyssa Ravasio had a similar inspiration. She started her website, Hip Camp, at first just to help people figure out where to camp.
But what I learned through doing that really quickly was that there was this bigger underlying problem, which was that all the campgrounds are booked.
She, too, had the idea to try to unlock access to private land for campers. At first, she says it was a slog to sign up landowners, but Hip Camp now has about 15,000 campsite hosts, up from just a couple thousand last year. People like Blake Romanesco.
We are here at my land that I called Trembling Gardens, is the name. 5 acres, most of it is swamp and marsh.
This site, about 10 minutes outside Duluth, Minnesota, is not for those who don't want to rough it. The hike in is through a muddy swamp. He just had his first campers the day before I visited.
There's space for a tent, table, chairs, got some tiki torches, a little fire pit.
Hip Camp and Tenter are bringing the sharing economy to the backcountry. They make money by taking a 10 to 20% cut of booking fees. Camp hosts set their own prices, and they vary. Romanesco charges $20. The average Tenter site costs around $120, but that includes a canvas tent, a bed, and other amenities. D'Agostino says some camp keepers, as he calls them, will make $12,000 this year. But landowners like Adam Lindquist also have another motivation. He rents out 2 campsites for $25 each on his small vineyard about an hour south of Minneapolis.
It's a really neat thing. It's a wonderful way to, again, you know, to share the land, to get people to out. You know, my whole philosophy is get out and use it.
Lindquist doesn't just talk the talk. His day job? He's Teddy Roosevelt. Seriously. He impersonates the former president and public lands champion and travels the country lobbying for conservation causes.
As Roosevelt himself said, man was not meant to be an oyster. Go explore. Go have fun.
And now more and more you can do that on private land. Both Tenter and HipCamp are quickly adding new listings, trying to cash in on the more than 40 million Americans who camp every year. So what do public landowners think of these venture capital-backed upstarts? Pat Arndt with Minnesota State Parks says bring them on.
I think the more camping options we have in Minnesota, the more people will have out camping.
She says she's not too worried about the new competition, at least not yet. In Duluth, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
From time to time, we bring you the stories of people around the country and how the economy feels to them, in their own words. We call this series My Economy, and here's today's installment.
I'm Joy O'Brien. I am living in Stowe, Massachusetts, in Central Mass, and I am a nurse practitioner. Working in urban environments with very, you know, poverty-stricken homeless families, that's kind of my passion area. That's the area that I want to work in. I actually grew up in a very stable family, but a very poor family. Briefly, we didn't have anywhere to live, too. So I have a deep feeling that I can meet these people with an area of understanding and compassion and not a sense of judgment. I've always wanted children. I started buying books at the school book fair when I was 8 and writing notes to my future children, you know, oh, I really like this book in third grade. I hope you do too. And I've also always known that I wanted to adopt children. Life circumstances have actually made that an essential, but that's not a blow for me, except for the financial aspect and that's an unachievable thing right now. We can't afford adoption, and I can't afford not to work full time to pay off my student loans. So I'm paying $2,100 a month in loan repayments, which is about half of my salary. I made what seemed like a logical career decision to do something that was fulfilling and meaningful to the world and could make a difference in people's lives. So I can help other people be moms, but I can't be a mom myself. In a perfect world, I would be able to do this and be a mom. And I don't think that it's fair that I have to pick.
We love to hear your story. Email us, write us a letter, whatever you'd like. We're at marketplace.org. This final note before we go today, it comes to us via the San Antonio Express News, where there's a gas shortage caused in large part, according to the mayor, by panic and hoarding. Apparently, the area is getting extra shipments of gas, but people are topping off their tank, filling up 55-gallon drums, and demand is 2.5 times what it usually is. On Facebook, the mayor has asked for calm and consideration. He posted a clip from It's a Wonderful Life.
Don't look now, but there's something funny going on over there at the bank, George. I've never really seen one, but that's got all the earmarks of being a run.
And he wrote, share with one another and be a good neighbor. That's always good advice. U.S. markets were closed today for the holiday. They'll reopen tomorrow. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrienne Hill. Kai's going to be back here with you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.